May it please the court, my name is Timms Fowler, and I represent Johnny Doe in this matter, along with co-counsel who's seated at appellant's table, Steve Gerard, number 15983. Thank you for having us for oral argument. It's an honor to be here. We briefed 5 issues for the court. I have 15 minutes. Hence, I will be focusing on probably 1 or 2 issues that I think are more fundamental for the disposition of the appeal. I'd like to reserve approximately 5 to 7 minutes, if I might.
That'll be up to you to keep track of, but you get the yellow light at 5 minutes.
Thank you. I'm going to start with just a quote, although this is the Court of Appeals, about childhood. Because this case is about 3 things. It's about the loss of innocence in a child. It's about basically 3 rules, CRCP 1, Rule 16, and Rule 56 in the summary judgment context. But this is a quote from Francis Thomas. You know what it is to be a child? It's something very different from the man of today. It is to have a spirit, yet swimming from the waters of baptism. It is to believe in love, believe in lovelies, to believe in belief. It is to be so little that elves can reach to whisper in your ears. It is to turn pumpkins into coaches, mice into horses, lowness into loftiness, and nothing into everything. Every child has a fairy godmother in its soul. Obviously, the record's been presented to you, and you know what happened to Johnny Doe. I will not belabor that. We're here to talk about duty and the district court's ruling on duty. That's the principal determination by which Doe lost in the trial court. But let's talk about duty in the context of the babysitting arrangement. The opportunity for Brian to molest Johnny Doe repeatedly was created, fostered, supported by Mr. Ullman, his restaurant, for the benefit of the restaurant. Hence, there should be a duty imposed under Colorado law to protect children in this context. When an employer offers up an employee and son to provide child daycare, childcare at night in an unsupervised setting where the child is 3 and the child care provider is 15 out of the presence of the mother, there should be a duty to use reasonable care in the selection, the hiring, the supervision of that 15-year-old.
So what facts and evidence here gave the defendants any cause to believe that Brian would molest this young boy?
There are 3 basic areas. First of all, there was the first finding about pornography. The pornography was discovered. Brian was viewing that at his mother's home.
Right. Is your position that any teenage boy who looks at pornography is at risk of sexually assaulting a child? See, that's the problem. I mean, and we have some experts in this case who've already said, you know, yeah, teenage boys look at pornography, even hardcore pornography. I think everybody recognizes in the briefs, you've got to make a nexus here, some connection between the conduct that the defendants knew about and what happened. And I'm having trouble, I'm just be candid with you, I'm having trouble connecting those 2 dots. So persuade me that the pornography alone doesn't get me there.
It does not alone.
Okay.
But we have pornography viewed 1 time. Okay. Then we have failed memories as to what that pornography was. The pornography was significant enough for Mr. Ullman and his former wife, Yolanda Howard, to take Brian, the youth counselor, at the local church. Okay? How many parents would rush their children off? They're both divorced, they get together and talk about it, and they take their son to the youth pastor for counseling. That's significant to my mind, and I think a jury should be entitled to make the determination of how significant that is, particularly when we have the failed memories of Ms. Howder and Mr. Ullman. They don't remember the nature of the pornography. If you believe that, I'll sell you a bridge in San Francisco. Okay? Their child was charged as a juvenile delinquent. He was adjudicated. That's significant. The police investigated, and then they say they don't understand. Mrs. Howard can't remember what that pornography was. Then there's the youth counselor. They take him to the youth counselor. Then they assert a privilege. They don't remember what the pornography was, but now there's a privilege with the youth counselor, even though one or both of them are sitting there. Okay, we get no more depositions than the standard two, so we can't take to pose the youth pastor to even probe the likelihood of what the scope and nature of that privilege is. So we've got first pornography, youth counselor, then we catch the nexus to employment. But I almost caught watching pornography at the restaurant.
No, I think you misunderstand Judge Gabriel's question. It's not a nexus to the employment. It's a nexus between whatever character shortcomings or misbehavior Brian engaged in and a probabilistic statement that he would molest a three-year-old child.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor, for redirecting. I just want to try to lay out the scenario that I found and I briefed extensively. So then we have the second incident at the restaurant. The other characteristics are that Brian, admittedly, as laid out in the brief, he has problems with anger, control. He's very angry with his stepmother. He's had counseling for that. He's got a host of issues about stepmother anger, control.
Was there any evidence that the molesting of the child was done in a fit of anger by Brian?
Not that I'm aware of. We have very few facts.
So what does the anger issue have to do with the harm that was suffered here?
It has to do with suitability, Your Honor. We're talking about the general characteristics that make someone either suitable or unsuitable.
Okay. Under the Keller analysis, is unsuitability sufficient to create a duty where the ultimate misconduct is an intentional tort that is also a criminal act? I mean, I have no doubt that you created a fact issue as to whether Brian was a suitable babysitter. What I'm not seeing is the nexus, as narrowly framed in Keller, between being an unsuitable babysitter and predictive of sexual assault.
Okay. Your Honor, let me address that directly. I think under Keller it's difficult, but under Moses versus Moses it's much easier. The language in Moses versus Moses is distinct and separate from Keller. And Moses v. Moses fits beautifully with this case. It's actually Moses versus Diocese of Colorado. And let me mention 3 points of law, if I might, about that, and then I'll talk more about the facts. First of all, liability employer is predicated on the employer's antecedent ability to recognize a potential employee's attributes of character or prior conduct which would create an undue risk of harm to those who would come in contact with. Number one. Number two, the employer's duty in exercising reasonable care in hiring decisions depends on the anticipated degree of contact with the other person. Okay? We've got Mr. Ullman's ability to know his son is heightened. That's extraordinarily high. We have the anticipated degree of contact and repeated babysitting in an unsupervised setting in a private home. The contact, the anticipated contact, is extraordinarily high. The third point is, the requisite degree of care increases, the duty increases, and may require expanded inquiry into the employee's background when the employer expects the employee to have frequent contact with the public, or when the nature of the employment fosters close contact and a special relationship between particular persons and the employee. That fits exactly this case. We have a 15-year-old boy, a 3-year-old child, frequent contact, repeated contact, close contact, special relationship. Brian Ullman is the employee and partner in this babysitting scheme with his father, and there's plenty of facts to support it. The defendants dispute it, but that's a question of fact. But that close contact repeatedly, Keller's much different. Keller deals with facts that an employer had an employee. The employee went and got a 12-year-old girl, okay, invited her to go to work with him. That's not connected with the employee's work whatsoever. He takes her to the place of employment, which is simply a venue for the assault. It has no connection to the employee's work, scope of work, involvement with his employer. He just takes the 12-year-old there, uses the bathroom, sexually assaults her. Okay, he didn't gain access to the 12-year-old based on the employment. Here we have the access to Johnny Doe's house is based on the employment relationship between Mr. Ullman and Mother Doe. He provides and selects his son who's being compensated by paying down his cell phone bill to babysit, provide daycare. All the access, the whole system is based on what Brian Ullman's supposed to be doing, and that is to take care of a three-year-old child. He's within the course and scope of his assignment. His father, Mr. Ullman, drove him there every single time. David Ullman drove him to the private home, knowing a three-year-old's there, with the whole intent. The whole intent is exactly what happened. Not in the assault, but in the setup.
I guess I don't see the whole intent is what happened. I'm troubled by it, and it strikes me with all due respect as an overstatement.
Well, that is an overstatement in and of itself. Yeah. I agree, Your Honor. What I'm trying to say is the purpose, though, was Mother Doe was to, the babysitting setup, the child care setup was so Mother Doe could leave the private residence to return to the restaurant to work. That's intended. It's intended that the child be left alone so Mother can go back to work to benefit the restaurant. It's intended that Brian be there by himself unsupervised. That's intended. Okay, all those things tie it directly into the babysitting scheme, which is linked inextricably to the restaurant and Mr. Ullman's conduct, even by driving him there. So then we get to Moses, and let me say, the court basically rejected the narrow interpretation that you're proposing, Judge Webb. Bishop Fry and the diocese contend that in order to establish a claim of negligent hiring, the plaintiff must show that the employer was aware of the employee's specific propensity and that the employee has a history of criminal, tortious, or other dangerous conduct. We disagree. You don't have to have a specific propensity, and that's what the district court held.
Sure, but in Moses, the court, that footnote that you're looking at then goes on to say you have to have certain character propensities, and in Moses, Father Robinson, there are psychological reports about him that the diocese had about sexual issues regarding him. What evidence is it that would suggest if you put him in a confidential relationship, he might be a problem? That strikes me, you know, push back, as different than this case, where what we know is you got a teenage kid who has control issues, problem with his parents, you know, behavioral issues, but I'm not seeing still the facts that get me to put the defendants on notice that this kid may sexually molest a child. Where is the evidence of that?
The evidence is that it's unsuitable given the facts and circumstances of the arrangements, Your Honor, taken in the totality of it, okay? The priest, Father Robinson, had sexual identification ambiguity. Okay, that's not very specific. That doesn't say he's going to enter into a sexual relationship with a parishioner. That doesn't mean that. He's got depression and low self-esteem. Those were the three things that the Supreme Court looked at and said, no, that's enough to impose a duty, and the duty was violated. Depression, low self-esteem, and sexual identity issues. Here we've got viewing pornography, probably bestiality, if we could ever get the depositions and get down far enough to test, because Mother Howard doesn't know, Mr. Ullman doesn't know, nobody remembers, okay? If we had a chance to get the discovery, we might have more concrete facts. But we are eclipsed, to be polite.
Can you address, I know you want to save time for rebuttal, and you got about a minute 47. I don't understand what precluded you from doing the discovery. I recognize Brian was evasive and all that. What does that have to do with your inability to take these other depositions earlier?
We need more depositions, Your Honor. We have two non-party depositions. The court would not give us a single additional deposition.
Why did you ask for them in April or May?
We thought we'd be able to depose the number one offender, Brian Ullman. We served him in Colorado. We had a glitch on its date. We served him in Nebraska. He didn't appear. We asked for letters rogatory to issue on November 26th or so of 2011. They issued on November 29th. We were back in Nebraska trying to tag him and get him deposed and get his mother deposed.
Why couldn't you take the depositions of the other people at the same time?
We didn't have the numerosity.
Well, why didn't you ask for it back then?
How far back? April?
Anytime. You waited till a month before the deadline was up.
We thought we'd get Brian deposed, and we thought his parents might be honest in their depositions.
Okay.
To be honest with you, I mean, how is the likelihood that a parent, when they go through this sort of thing, has no clue You probably, oh, you read the all the, about 33 seconds, the colloquy from Yolanda Howard about, you know, websites, why would I need to keep this crap in my head? I don't know. She had no interest in hardcore and softcore pornography. You know, those are questions of fact. There's enough there in Joe Lyle opined that the link between pornography and child molestation is strong. Their own defense expert, who wasn't even disclosed, Pamela Rodden, she opined that there was a link between pornography and sex abuse, too. I'll reserve 1 second. Thank you.
Thank you, Liz Gore.
Counsel? This is a remarkable case in what plaintiff suggests for you to hold.
Counsel, I know you are. Would you introduce yourself?
Yes, I'm Todd Friesen. I represent the two defendants, David Ullman and Philip Smith.
Thank you. I'm sorry.
There is a Brian Ullman there as well. Yeah, but for the record, I'm Todd Friesen. Thank you. This is a remarkable case in the breadth of what the plaintiff seeks for you to hold today. This does rise out of a teenage babysitting situation, and it does ride out hold upon that phrase that we repeated throughout the complaint, was repeated throughout the complaint, and it's discussed in great lengths in our brief, that antisocial conduct that's alleged. And I don't mean to belittle teenagers. I don't mean to belittle situations when you have to go see a school counselor or you have to go see a youth pastor in a situation. And I don't certainly belittle the travesty that happened to this young child. All right. But the ramifications of both the duty that's being placed upon a parent here in this situation to try and anticipate the emotional problems of situations that are not particularly uncommon, which is a divorce, or bad grades at school, or a variety of other issues that we've talked about. You heard control problems are an issue. Let's just observe, as we all can, and as the trial court judge did in this situation, teenagers test boundaries. Teenagers have control issues. That's being part of growing up and being a teenager. There are sometimes conflicts and issues with regard to emotional problems with regard to divorce. So what we were presented with in this particular situation was a teenager that was struggling through his teenage years in that situation, all right? And part of that is, unfortunately, in our society, using the internet and viewing pornography. We have proactive parents in this situation that caught him through looking through internet history review and being good parents, caught him with that, and because of they were of a religious mind, well, how they dealt with that in their own way was to not only lecture him personally, as parents should do, but took him to the youth pastor to talk with him about that. None of this is remarkable in the sense of what you were focusing in on the questions, and as we focused in our brief, is that, all right, I get it, all right, maybe this was a 15-year-old boy, or it could be a girl in this situation that's struggling through his or her teenage years. What does that have to do with anticipating or having a propensity, as some of the cases refer to, or having that connection, so connected, as other cases refer to a child sexual assault? And that was the debate throughout the entire underlying case in all the discovery. And the reason why this is not only a remarkable case that's presented to you is the wide-ranging aspects, because if you adopt what plaintiff asks you to do is stretching the law beyond its current recognition. You can imagine the situation of not only is a duty of a parent to say, has my teenager created some type of or involved in some type of antisocial conduct? I think, as we as parents would say, yeah, on occasion that was not right, a very good decision. Does our teenager have a situation with regard to control authority? Does our teenager have that type of situation? Do I want to put myself into potential liability by, as you just heard, driving the teenager? Have I assumed a duty by driving the teenager who can't drive to the babysitting event? Am I now involved with a potential negligent supervision claim? What do I do? Or even going one step beyond that, under the non-disclosure and concealment claim, which was the second motion, second order that's being appealed here. If I, as a parent, Do I sit down and say, okay, now under the new standard that's being proposed by the plaintiffs for antisocial conduct or wrongful conduct, how do I fulfill that duty of disclosure?
Let me ask you a couple questions about this. As I read the lower court's second summary judgment ruling, the court essentially applied the same Keller analysis to non-disclosure as it had previously applied to the various negligent claims.
That's correct.
Well, materiality is an element of non-disclosure and concealment.
Yes.
How can Keller be applied to a basic materiality question? Or put it another way, wouldn't a reasonable mother in the position of the mother here be interested in knowing the problems that Brian had so that she could simply say, I don't want this kid as my babysitter, wholly apart from the nexus requirement from Keller?
Yeah, the key to your answer, the key to the answer is in your question when you said, isn't a mother interested in knowing? And that's always going to be a question of fact, and that's a subjective standard. And I suggest to you there needs to be an objective standard to the term materiality.
But how is Keller a materiality test if you and I agree as to what a reasonable mother would like to know before turning her three-year-old child over to a stranger?
Yeah, well, that's the insidious part of this disclosure whole idea, and that is, how am I supposed to know? First of all, I'm not to anticipate any type of criminal acts or other kinds of things as a parent or as anybody in a situation. I'm not responsible for this act. But if that kind of duty is being opposed here, how do I now, as a parent, who's my daughter or son's about ready to babysit for a teenager, how do I fulfill that duty prior to the babysitting? Do I have a piece of paper that says, here's the amount of time that they've seen the school counselor, and here's the type of pornography, or here's the situation where we fought with my daughters and sisters, here's the emotional divorce situation, here's this, sign this piece of paper, because now I've done full disclosure of all that antisocial conduct, and you now, I fulfilled my duty to disclose that. Are you interested in anything else, potential parent? It's an unworkable potential for the parent of the potential babysitting situation. It's unworkable as to how a parent would be able to fulfill that duty of non-disclosure to a potential parent as to what do you need to know about the antisocial conduct of my teenager prior to babysitting, so I can fulfill my duty of disclosure.
Don't courts make that judgment, or juries make that judgment every day in all kinds of fraud cases by saying materiality is based on what a reasonable person, typically in the position of the investor, for example, would like to know?
Yes.
Here I'm saying that the question is a reasonable parent. What would they like to know about a babysitter? Can't a jury perform that function completely separate from this very specific nexus requirement in Keller?
Yeah, but that's the materiality that you're using in your mind, whether it be financial disclosures or SEC disclosures, you still have that materiality disclosure, and that's why you get 60-page booklets with regard to disclosures and the forward-looking statements and a variety of other things that if you that may allow you to fulfill the duty beforehand. But getting to your situation here, look, if that's the standard and if that's that subjective analysis that we're going to go through here, let me tell you that for a year, my clients went through the most insidious litigation, in my point of view and in their point of view, whereby they were deposed, not only throughout their, about all the personal aspects with regard to their divorce, not only the all personal aspects with regard to their school, not only all the personal aspects with regard to Brian and his acting out and whether he obeyed certain rules and not, but because this was a sexual assault situation and because there was a theory that sexual assaulters or predators come from families that include sexual predators or other types of situations, as you saw from my brief, they were asked questions about their personal sexual habits, about how they grew up, how they learned the birds and the bees. And unless there's a bright line situation here, that unless there's that propensity, that strong nexus, that strong connectivity, something that must be disclosed with regard to the criminal act, you're going to have litigation after litigation after litigation that says this general rubric of the teenager, or the baby, doesn't have to be a teenager for that matter, it can be any person, had antisocial conduct or wrongful conduct, and then you'll go through 8 months worth of litigation, discovery, and issues to try and find out what the context of that was as to whether or not they fulfilled the duty of disclosure and to fulfill that materiality aspect of it. I can't tell you how painful this was for my clients when the usual rule is that David Ullman, as the parent, is not liable for the criminal acts of his son during babysitting, nor should any parent be resulting of that. And then getting to the employer, let's not forget the fact that all the cases, including the Moses case and other cases, they all assumed that there was an employment situation here. What you have here is someone who was clearly not employed. By law, he could not be employed since he was 15 years old. This restaurant served liquor. And he could not be employed, never got any paychecks, never did anything along those lines. But the nexus that's being provided in those lines of cases is that they indirectly benefited, the employer did, by his babysitting, which allowed the mother, who was the employee, to work. So let's not forget that aspect of that. We have this, not only this parent protection here with regard to what your teenager does, but we have a number of cases that are being cited by the plaintiff in an employment situation where we have no facts in this situation that there was, in fact, any employment of this 15-year-old by that.
Mr. Erickson, if I can ask you, trying to figure out where the line comes here, and Mr. Fowler, I think, correctly said, you know, Moses, we don't have any direct, at least what the Supreme Court opinion says, and there's no direct evidence that the Father Robinson had abused any women in the past. Mm-hmm. We have, Mr. Fowler, you were describing correctly, sexual identity issues, depression, whatever else. There was some evidence in that case that depression might lead someone to do this. I recognize that this is perhaps a hypothetical. Where's the line? Would there be enough for a duty if Brian looked at child pornography? Did he have to actually have molested a child before? Where is the line? Where would there be a duty in your view?
Yeah, well, that's not me for to provide, nor for you to provide. That was for the plaintiff to provide. So, for example, the record is devoid of any evidence, of any scientifically sound evidence, to use that phrase, to fulfill that evidentiary gap between some type of conduct, even child pornography, and being that propensity to commit child sexual assault. There was no expert that was presented saying, here's a study, here's scientifically sound evidence, here's something to make that leap that you're trying to provide. It was simply someone who came on and said, forbidden, from a forbidden point of view, well, he had personality and he had characteristics or whatever, and so I think, in my professional opinion, he may act in accordance with that personality and characteristics. And the case law after case law after case law says in Colorado, we don't do that here. We don't judge somebody based upon personality and traits and characteristics. We have to have some scientifically sound evidence to provide that, to fulfill that evidentiary gap that you're struggling with, and so did we.
And I know the court struck Dr. Lau, but if there was a qualified psychologist from your point of view, and the qualified psychologist put on that kind of evidence, in your view, that could lead to a fact question on duty.
Yes, theoretically, but you remember that we encountered with Dr. Rock, and we asked her that question, who was SLMD certified, and said, is this something? And they said, well, it's something that I'd like to look at, but it certainly does not lead to it as we would do that. But yes, theoretically, they could approach it in those two ways.
Thank you.
So in summary then, I really would like for you to consider not only the Keller versus Coca case, which is striking in the fact that you had a situation there where you had actual sexual harassment situations and physical conduct by employees, and yet the Colorado Supreme Court decided in that situation that there was no duty by that particular person. All right, or you take the other cases and you find out when there's not an employment situation, as there's not a year, that there is no such duty for an employer or a potential employer, unless you have a propensity, or unless you have it so connected to the later criminal act that there comes to be some type of duty to do more. And without that, if you stick with what plaintiff alleged and what would really trouble the district court below, was that, as the district court says, all material, all behavior, bad behavior by a particular person is not material. And this court instead should, therefore, should affirm the district court's review of that evidence and hold that no legal liability exists by a parent or an employer when that parent's teenage child commits a criminal act during babysitting. Any other contrary decision, even the decision to go in front of a jury, would wreak havoc on the babysitting, thousands of babysitting transactions that occur in Colorado.
There aren't as many cases, though, are there, counsel, where the parent goes to an employee and says, look, I need you to work more hours. I'll provide my 15-year-old son to babysit for your child so you can work those longer hours, even though he's knowledgeable, to use your term, that if the son is struggling, that he likes to watch, look at pornography. There aren't any cases like that that you've come across.
There's no babysitting cases at all in Colorado, and I would distinguish the fact that we need to watch out if any situation is, hey, I'll help you work out, I'll offer my son or I'll offer my daughter to do babysitting, whether that's an assumption of a duty, as the plaintiffs are suggesting, by simply me as a parent saying, oh, I hear you have a problem, a situation, you can have, my daughter is available or my son's available to babysit, has that by simply offering to do that in that situation, whether it be employment for something or something else, has that parent now injected himself into a liability situation by offering their child a babysit? And plaintiffs would say, yes, they do. And we would say, absolutely not. Thank you.
We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. Your times are exhausted. We will take the case under advisement and issue a written opinion in due course.